completely different style and completely different topic from mainstream of this workshop, so I apologize for this. But hopefully I'll entertain you for a while. And what I'll tell you a little bit about is sort of my informal workshop. I'll tell you a little bit about my own personal perspective on gravitational waves detection and on LIGO in particular. So the mantra that gravitational wave people usually say to advocate building huge detectors and spending lots of money on it, it goes approximately like this. They say that when the radar was invented, that people pointed radio telescopes at the sky, the picture of the universe was completely different from before, because before the optical observations showed, you know, gas and galaxies and universe looked pretty quiet. And of course, as soon as we looked at it, the radars discovered all those wonderful things like quasars, which would outshine the whole galaxies by a factor of 100, and pulsars and galaxies and collisions, and really, really violent and spectacular phenomena. So the argument goes that as soon as you change the window through which you are looking, you know, in this case, you change the wavelength of electromagnetic light, you're going to see dramatically different picture of the universe. And therefore, if you look at the universe with gravitational waves, which is even more radical change of the window, then the hope is that you discover things which are even more dramatic than what was done by radio astronomy in the middle of the century. And I hope that this logic is correct. I hope that indeed when we switch on gravitational wave detectors, that our view of the universe will be very different and improved and more exciting. But there is a caveat. And the caveat is that you can't just switch on gravitational wave detector and see new stuff. Gravitational waves are very weak signals. And before seeing something, you have to model it. You have to have some kind of a template of what you're looking for. If you don't have this template, the gravitational wave detector, the output of the gravitational wave detector will be just noise. So the point is that whereas with radio telescopes, you could just look at the sky and discover some new stuff which you didn't expect. In the business of gravitational wave astronomy, you have to expect it. The discovery first has to be made in your mind, or in somebody's mind. And then this has to be modeled. And then after after you make a good model, then you can take the output of your gravitational wave interferometer and compare your model with this output and see if you really see the signal that you think is there. So this is one point. Another point is that an interferometer like LIGO is really well, it's sort of a frontier of experimental science in a way, because things that people usually don't have to model, both in physics and astronomy context, you have to model pretty well. So, for example, the interferometer noise is, to some degree, a fundamental thing. The thermal fluctuations and quantum fluctuations become very important. So I'll talk about both of these things, and since I only have half an hour, I'll give you two short examples. So I won't give you a broad overview of LIGO, I'll just tell you a little bit about the design, so that you have a picture. So LIGO is basically a Michelson interferometer. It looks like this. It has a laser which shines in the beam splitter, and the beam splitter splits light into equal parts. And both parts go into a grid throughout cavity. So each of these arms contains a resonator, which is bounded by these two mirrors, this mirror and this mirror. And then these mirrors have high reflectivity, so the resonator has a high quality factor. It can accumulate light for many circulating periods. The light, after going into this cavity, comes back to the beam splitter. And the same happens in this arm. And then it recombines in such a way that all of it goes back to the laser, and none of this comes to this photodetector here. So the interferometer is essentially operated at a dark fringe, so to speak. Now, all this is proven, there is no gravitational wave, so no disturbances. When gravitational wave comes by, it has the right polarization. What happens is that the length of one of the arms effectively contracts, the length of the other arms effectively expands, and then the light fails to recombine in a perfect way, and part of it will leak out of the photodetector. So, in this sense, and that's how you see the signal base. That's the basic principle of operation. Now, of course, the noise is the key thing, right? Because all of the systems are going to be noisy. So, well, this is just to show. This is just to show you the construction site. There are two sites. This is the site in Hanford, Louisiana, I think.
Sorry,
it's Washington State. Yeah. Okay, yeah, it looks like Washington State. Right. So, each of these arms, I should have said, each of these resonators is 4 kilometers long. And so this is the main station here. So this is what the noise curve looks like. So this is a theoretical calculation of what the noise curve for the initial interferometer should look like. And on the x-axis, you have the frequency of your signal. And on the y-axis, you have sort of a dimensionless square root of the noise spectral density. So at low frequencies, basically below about 30 hertz, you are dominated by shaking of the ground. So because the ground is shaking, actually mostly due to ocean waves slamming into the beach, then this seismic signal propagates from the beach to the interferometer. So the ground is shaking, and it's very hard to isolate the interferometer from that. You have to go into space. Then in the mid-range, here from about 30 hertz to about a few, 150 or so hertz, the dominant source of noise is just thermal fluctuations of the mirrors and their suspensions. I'll talk about this a little bit more a little bit later. Then the high frequency end of the noise is basically due to the quantum nature of light. The fact that light consists of separate photons introduces sort of a Nyquist type noise in your output. Okay, now this is these are the curves of what, so this is what's predicted, or this is sort of the target sensitivity. And these are a few noise curves for the initial LIGO. And the latest one is shown here in red. And this is a few months old already. And so this dramatic improvement in in sensitivity, this is basically the time scale of a couple of years. You see this, orders of magnitude of improvement in sensitivity. And basically, right now, we are almost at the target sensitivity for LIGO 1. So this is very good news. It means that people have this dynamics is a good news. Not just the fact that you are close to the target, but it means that people sort of understand their system very well. And they know, they have some procedure of how to correct for the artificial noise sources in their detector. Right, so it gives us hope that these people know what they're doing and that LIGO will work as expected.
So now, them subtracting out known sources? Are they subtracting out sources in noise here?
No. There are no sources here, right? There are no. You mean astronomical?
No. You say that they're understanding the noise and they're.
No, what happens is that people see, okay, well, we have lots of low-frequency noise, it's probably due to some electronics, and then they go and rearrange their wires. So that's what I mean. They look at the noise curve and they see, okay, this probably comes from here, and then clever experimentalist knows which part of the detector to go and which screws to turn. Eventually it goes down. This sort of time dynamics gives me some confidence. I mean, I don't know anything about what's going on in detail in the lab. But I think it looks quite promising.
So what is this science going to mean? Is that when you use its sensitivity, you can detect it?
Right, that's a very good question. So the science goal of LIGO is constrained by this frequency window, right, in which you can have a signal. And you see that on the left side, below a few tens of hertz, you're bounded by seismic noise. And on the right side, you're almost always, beyond a few hundred hertz, you're almost always bounded by short noise due to fluctuations in light. So this leaves you the frequency window, a certain frequency window for gravitational waves that you can see. And yes, please. Well, let me just finish. Yeah. So, and this frequency window immediately implies that you're looking for something coming from neutron stars or stellar-dust black holes. That's basically the only thing that you can see with light. Some phenomenon connected to neutron stars or stellar-dust black holes. So I'll talk about, in a second, since I have very little time, I'll talk about one particular example where you can get some kind of window on neutron stars. Please.
Your integration time to get the red curve, how long does it take? Short, long, medium? Seconds, minutes, hours, days?
I'm not sure. I just don't know what they do. This is... I assume that it's over the whole time that the interferometer is held in law, one period of time the interferometer is held in law. But I'm not sure what it, which is days. I'm not sure. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about astrophysics. And I won't tell you about all astrophysics. I'll tell you just give you one particular example of the kind of thing you might hope to see with LIGO. So let me skip over a few other things.
Could you skip through more slowly, just so that we can get
Well, one.
No, forward.
So one. Okay. One thing is binaries, right? The natural thing is that when there is a binary, a pair of neutron stars, and they merge, they give you a gravitational wave signal. And this is good news because we know that these things exist in the universe. Actually, this is one of the only sources in life that we for sure are confident exists out there. And because we see them in our galaxy. Then there is more speculative things which involve binary, neutron star, black hole, binary. Then vibrating neutron stars, which vibrate as a result of supernova explosion. And then very speculatively, the physics in the universe, if intermediate dust black holes merge in the early universe, the product will be vibrating at a frequency which, after propagating through the whole of the universe, will be potentially be seen by light. I'm going to skip through all
of the Calogero estimate, which actually had a specific number, which is... It went up to 10,000 per year or something?
Yes.
Most of that, is that actually LIGO 1? That's presumably LIGO 2.
That's LIGO 2. That's not. So I must say that the Lurch curves I sent just for initial LIGO. So within a few years, actually in 2007, they'll make updates of the systems of LIGO 1. And by about 2010, this update should be finished. And the noise curve should go down by about 1.5 orders of magnitude. It should be LIGO 2. So hopefully they'll do as well for LIGO 2 as they're doing for LIGO 1. Okay, so my mission here is not to give a broad overview of LIGO astrophysics, but just tell you something concrete that you can remember. What I want to tell you about is about accreting neutron stars and known as X-ray binaries. So the hero of the story sitting here, it's a neutron star, and it's sitting in the middle of the accretion disk. And not only it has a accretion disk, not only this neutron star has a accretion disk around itself, but it also has a companion, a binary companion, which is shown here distorted. It's not spherical due to the tidal force exerted by this neutron star. And in fact, it's so distorted that a trickle of material sort of comes onto the accretion disk, and then eventually accretes to the neutron star. Now, the interesting thing is that the secretion disk, it spins the neutron star up to very high frequencies. And we can measure those frequencies for some of the neutron stars in this low mass X-ray binary. Let me just tell you how this is done. What happens astrophysically is that the material accumulates on the surface of the neutron star and then spreads out as sort of a thin layer. And when this thin layer of hydrogen and helium turns to be about a few meters high, then basically the gravity of neutron star compresses this material to very high densities. So it's highly compressed hydrogen and helium. This is like a hydrogen bomb. And it gives you a nuclear explosion. Actually, this whole shell on the surface of the neutron star explodes. You know, burns like just like a hydrogen bomb here on Earth. Except for it engulfs the whole shell and doesn't do it instantly. It doesn't sort of gradually. And because the neutron star is rotating, then this fire, which is burning on the surface of the neutron star, will be modulated with rotation frequency. And that's what people see. So this is the X-ray luminosity as a function of time. So this is the signature of this nuclear explosion. All of a sudden, the X-ray luminosity goes up by an order of magnitude or so. And then it gradually decays after the burning is finished. And so superposed on this is sort of the frequency signal, the signal, the frequency of modulation of this X-ray luminosity for this particular burst. You see this signal is pretty stable, so this is the frequency on the y-axis. It changes a little bit, drifts basically by a couple of hertz, but in this particular case, asymptotes pretty stable to 364 hertz at the end of the burst. And this recurs from burst to burst, right? This happens every few hours, and it always comes to this 364 hertz. And the only way they can get such a stable asymptotic frequency is if the neutron star is rotating to 364 hertz. So that's how you measure the spins of this neutron star. Let me just show you, for fun, a picture of simulation of how this burning occurs that we've done a couple of years ago. So this is the simulations from, this just shows you how the fire engulfs the neutron star, and there are all the various symmetries, it's mostly solid and stuff like this. Anyway, this is not the most important thing. And this is in rotating, in the frame which is rotating in the neutron star. Just to show you how, for you to have a picture how this kind of fire can spread around. Okay, so. Just coming back to this point, the spins which have been measured for all the neutron stars and low mass X-ray binaries have all been in a fairly narrow range, between 240 and 700 hertz. And there is no particular reason why the neutron star, which is accreting from accretion disk and being spun up by accretion torque, why it should stop at 700 hertz. There is no convincing astrophysical reason why this should be the upper end. And this upper end is, you know, statistically significant. So Lars Bilton in 98, he already argued that this upper end is most likely to be due to gravitational radiation. This is sort of astrophysical evidence and gravitational radiation is sure. By no means, don't think it's like 100% certain, but it's sort of an indication. Okay, well, how do you make spinning neutron star to radiate gravitational waves? One thing is if you find the way to build a mountain, right? If you find a way to build a mountain on a neutron star, then this mountain will rotate around, and it will emit gravitational waves with a frequency of twice the spin of the neutron star and the spin of the neutron star, so it'll be two frequency bands where those gravitational waves were emitted. Now, the gravity of neutron star is extremely intense. It's very hard to build a mountain. So the theorists who build mountains of neutron stars have to be really clever to do this, right? They go to a great deal of sort of effort and sometimes leaps of faith, I would say, to build these mountains. However, it's interesting, and the frequency signal is very definite. There is another way to make neutral star gravitate, radiate gravitational waves, which is appealing because here gravity is actually is on your side. And this way was realized by Chandrasekhar in 1970 and later developed more full detail by his students, Friedman and Schultz. So that's why it's called CFS stability. Chandrasekhar, Friedman and Schultz. And in this picture, the waves, the gravitational waves, are radiated by waves which are propagating on the neutral star itself. The basic idea is that suppose we have a neutral star which is rotating clockwise on this diagram. And suppose you excite a wave which is trying to go in the opposite direction. So some kind of ocean wave, which is moving backwards. And then, as was proved by these people, if the speed of this wave is slower than the rotation of the star, meaning that for a person who lives in the star, the wave goes backwards. But for the person who is an inertial observer, the pattern of the wave is still moving in the same sense as the rotation of the star. So long as this is true, and you couple this wave somehow to any kind of field, for example, gravitational radiation, then this wave will always be unstable. This is a very general theorem. And the reason why this theorem is general is very simple. Basically, the canonical angular momentum of the wave which is going backwards is negative. But if its pattern is dragged forwards, the angular momentum, the gravitational waves which are radiated by this pattern, carry off the positive angular momentum. So in order for the positive angular momentum radiating by gravitational waves to be compensated, this wave on a neutral star which carries negative angular momentum must grow. Okay, so that's the meaning of this theorem. The argument is quite simple. Now the difficulty for theorists is to find the right wave. And the most naive waves that you think about don't work. Because if I wanted to make an ocean wave like this, which goes backwards, the neutral star is a very strongly gravitating body, and basically you would find that the wave goes too fast. You can't really rotate fast enough. The wave goes very fast. However, it took 20 years for people basically to find the right wave, and coincidentally it was done in the same year as Dilthey realized gravitational waves may be important for the system. So these waves are now, the waves which work are now called R modes. And the general phenomenon that I've described, where this R modes grow due to the emission of gravitational waves, is called R mode instability. And R modes look like kind of giant vorticity waves on the surface of the neutral star. So imagine that on the equator there are these centers of vorticity, and around each of the centers there is vorticity pattern. And it's not stationary relative to the neutral star, but it's traveling backwards relative to neutral star rotation. Now, because it's traveling backwards, the gravitational waves which are emitted by the small have a frequency different from that emitted by a mountain. So the gravitational wave frequency is 4/3 of the spin frequency of the neutral star. So if you see a spinning neutral star in our galaxy and we measure gravitational waves coming from it, if these gravitational waves are from a mountain, the frequency of this wave will be commensurate with the frequency of rotation of the neutral star. If they come from R modes, the frequency will be 4/3 of the spin. So there's a very clear way to distinguish them. Now, interestingly, it turns out that the nature, the behavior of the gravitational waves is sensitive to the viscosity of the neutral star matter. So, in principle, by observing this wave, you can get some insight into how friction works inside the neutral star. So I realized this a number of years ago, basically 5 years ago. And the reason viscosity is important is, of course, for the wave to grow, you must overcome the viscous damping, right? So if the growth timescale due to gravitational radiation must be smaller than the viscous damping, the time scale of viscous damping. It turns out that if the viscosity of a neutral star behaves like that of a normal matter, in the following sense, if the neutral star viscosity decreases as the temperature of the neutral star increases, then the gravitational waves which come from a neutral star will be unstable. In the sense that they'll come in flashes, right? So what will happen is that the neutral star will, well, I'll show it on the next picture. So this is, okay, let me just quickly explain the axis. On the x-axis, you have the temperature of the core of the neutral star. On the y-axis, you have the spin. And what happens is that the neutral star is sitting at a fixed temperature of the core, and then it's gradually spinning up, you know, over the course of millions of years. And then when it reaches some threshold spin frequency, the instability is triggered, and the modes heat up the neutral star. And as they heat up the neutral star, the viscosity goes down, and so the instability becomes stronger, and there is a runaway. But when there is a flash of gravitational waves, which lasts a few thousand years, right? This is astrophysics. So a few thousand years is really short. And then the gravitational waves are all emitted in this, you know, a few thousand years. And then again, there are millions of years that it takes to spin this neutral star up. Okay, so this is if the viscosity behaves as normal matter. If the viscosity behaves as abnormal matter, for example, due to some superfluid effects or hyperon viscosity in neutral star core. Now, this will not happen, right? That when the gravitational waves emitted by a neutral star will be very steady. You know, then there will be no radical time variations.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
You used the word hyperon, but you also said superfluidity, and one does expect that the bulk of the neutron star will be superfluid.
That's right.
And does it hold for, I think it's D-type superfluidity as well? I mean, because that's what makes the superfluid.
Right. Well, I must say that nobody has really calculated. So I think people have calculated the effect of superfluidity on the damping due to the superfluid in the core of the neutron star. And that doesn't seem to make much difference. However, the theorists believe there's also superfluid in the crust as well. Because at the bottom of the crust,
which is S-wave.
Right. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And so basically, one can have different behaviors of dN by dt depending upon depth.
That's right.
And most important is surface dN by dt.
Well, it has never been calculated, right? So this is something to do. It hasn't really been calculated. Let me just show you the calculations which don't include superfluidity. So this is a primitive diagram for 5 years ago, but a few years ago we recalculated this diagram with Gregor Shumirsky for a more realistic neutron star model which doesn't include superfluidity. And so this is the core temperature, this is the spin frequency in Hertz for neutron star. And this square is where all of the observed neutron stars and more or less extreme binaries are sitting. Now, and these two lines, so this line, the thick line here, and then there is the dotted line, is the instability curve of the R nodes for two different thicknesses of the crust. For both of these thicknesses are allowed by realistic models. Now, when I say stability curve, I mean that above this curve, the R node becomes unstable, and below it, it's stable. So it seems that current data favors thick crust, for example. But because we haven't included all the effects, you know, I don't want to take it too seriously. So perhaps when somebody like myself goes and calculates the effect of superfluidity on this stuff, then we'll be able to make more reliable statements about. And of course, when gravitational wave detectors see something like this, then we'll learn a lot about the structure of, we'll learn a lot about this viscous process of the seismic stuff.
How
well
do we know the crest temperatures? Just
to say that you have, you know.
How much time do I have?
Well, almost no time, say, 5 days.
Well, I'm happy to actually stop here and take questions. I'm also happy to stop.
If you just start the conclusions and
keep going. Okay. So the reason I'm happy to stop and take questions is because in the remaining few minutes I was planning to talk about something completely different. Okay. So I'm finished with the physics part, and I have 5 minutes, right? Right. I want to talk about another side of LIGO where I think theorists can make contributions, or have made contributions. And this is this whole issue of thermal noise, the thermal fluctuations. And so remember, thermal noise comes in the mid-range, so the sensitivity of LIGO to most signals, is very crucially sensitive to the amount of thermal noise we have in the system. We have to understand this very well. So what is thermal noise? Well, basically thermal noise is due to sort of anti-Maxwell demons which are sitting in your system. So what do I mean by that? Well, here is a mirror. Here's a picture of the mirror. And here is some kind of impurity which is sitting inside the mirror. And what this impurity will do, because it's coupled to thermal bath, it will create random stresses, right? There is some guy who's sitting inside the mirror, it just pushes in random directions, right? Because of these random stresses, this mirror will not be, you know, like we designed it to be perfectly cylindrical, but it will have some random deformation of its shape, okay? And of course, if you're shining with light on the left side of this mirror, this random deformations of the shape of the mirror will affect your signal. They'll contaminate your signal. Now, depending on whether this guy is sitting inside the mirror or in the suspension fiber, right? The nature of noise is called either internal thermal noise because it's internal to the mirror, or suspension thermal noise. Right? And the reason suspensions are important is because if somebody shakes suspension, the recoil of the test mass will feed into the laser measurement of the phase coming from the left side of the mirror. Okay, now so it sounds like a simple problem, but it was done in the wrong way for a long time. And so the way people were calculating it, I guess there is sort of intuition that as soon as you have some mechanical system, you must compose in normal mode, right? Just because you can. And that's what people were doing for a long time. So they would take whatever you give them and decompose it in normal modes. And so each of the modes would have some wave function, frequency, and the coupling coefficient. And so this alpha is the coupling coefficient of the modes to the laser beam. Right? So as soon as you give this to, say, a theorist, and the quality factor Q of the mode, then you know that the spectral density corresponding to each of these modes is just the Lorentzian, which is centered on the main frequency of the mode. Okay, and then what was done was that all these modes were taken and just added up, multiplied by the squares of this coupling coefficient. Okay, now this calculation turns out, so it probably looks to you like this is the thing to do, but actually it's wrong, and it shouldn't be done this way. And the reason it shouldn't be done this way is because it assumes that the modes are completely uncorrelated with each other. And basically, the correlation between these two modes is zero. But it doesn't have to be this way, right? Because this guy who is shaking the whole system, he doesn't care about modes, he doesn't know about them, right? So it can shake a few modes at the same time and introduce correlations. So the way to do the calculations correctly is to use the most general version of fluctuation dissipation theorem that you can possibly use. So fluctuation dissipation theorem is a very generous lady, right? You should just ask for something, and then it will answer. So what you're measuring here, in this case, right, this is a mirror, and you're shining on it with a laser beam. And you're measuring some function which is basically the integral of the surface of the mirror, of the displacement. So this quantity is written here as x. And just imagine this quantity is one of the generalized coordinates, right? Take it as one of the generalized coordinates of the system. And then the fluctuation dissipation theorem tells you in order to find fluctuations in this quantity, you have to do the following mental experiment. You have to imagine that you're pushing. You have to imagine that you're pushing on this generalized coordinate with some external force. So if you do some interaction in Newtonian, like this, with some periodic frequency, then you have to see what this generalized Hamiltonian, which is pushing on this system, what it does to the system. In particular, you have to go and calculate how much power is dissipated in the system. And then you have to come back and use this expression. So the spectral density of noise in this quantity will be basically the dissipated power divided by the amplitude of this forcing that you have applied to this generalized coordinate. And it turns out that this is a very simple prescription which works well. And I'll just finish that that if you use this prescription, you'll find new sources of thermal noise. So the new sources which were identified after this prescription was introduced was the noise from the coating, basically dielectric coating of the mirror, which makes a reflecting surface, which turns out to be actually the dominant source of thermal noise for second LIGO, right? So this noise will be dominating. Another source of noise which was identified was due to sort of random temperature fluctuations right next to the laser beam surface. And that basically comes about even though the average heat flow in thermal equilibrium is zero, but there are some random fluctuations around this value, and sometimes this point would get higher temperature and would be expanding, and then this would affect the beam signal. So all those things turn out to be important for LIGO. Let me just finish that with a sort of picture of the experimental data. So this is the prediction of the coating noise, and this is the data. And the experimentalist who published the data believe that here data is dominated by basically electronic noise in their system. But here the prediction is really very well, so it's kind of gratifying for me, you know, to see something that you've done actually confirmed in the lab. So, okay, I think I'll just stop here because I'm completely out of time and take questions.
It's good that you pointed out for this thermal noise, but one thing I'm wondering if you now, in order to, you know, for this LIGO and, you know, all these experiments, you require the laser beam to be very tolerant. And so how about, what about the decoherence effect? Because then the laser beam hits your mirror and gets this, you know, thermal noise, so I would expect your laser, I mean, the beam might get decoherent, it might lose its tolerance.
Well, that's...
So has anyone, I mean, do people think about this then?
Well, that's the same thing, mm-hmm. Right? It's just the same thing using different language. You can think of decoherent. For this case, I'm completely sure it's the same thing. But my sense is that if you are thinking about quantum systems and you're thinking about decoherence in quantum systems, you can always reformulate it in terms of noise. Mm-hmm. You can always find, you know, some Langevin operator which is forcing a system introducing a source of noise. It's just two equivalent ways.